This is Aviator Cast, episode 31, All Around the World.
Calling all aviators, pilots, and aviation lovers. Welcome to Aviator Cast, where we close the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Climb aboard, buckle up, and prepare for takeoff. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I have a sixth love language. It's spoken in acronyms like VFR, IFR, EFIS, ETA, METAR, and TAF, just to name a few. It's whispered in the whine of gyro instruments spooling up or the rushing air past a windscreen. Yes, I love flight. I'm the founder and owner of Angle of Attack, a flight simulation training company, which is bringing you this podcast today. Aviator Cast is a weekly podcast where we talk about the spirit of the aviator. We believe flying is an art form, one that we have to continually practice and master. This mastery is gained through a focus on continual learning, human factors, humility, and a commitment to excellence. Show notes, transcript, community discussion, and links for this episode can be found by simply going to aviatorcast.com. Welcome to this, the 31st episode of Aviator Cast. I'm absolutely excited to have you here. We have an awesome episode lined up for you. But first, I have a very special guest with me here, sitting on my lap. Her name is Chelsea. She is my wonderful wife, and she is going to read today's review because it comes all the way from Brazil. I don't speak Portuguese, and I'm just so lucky enough that she does. So here she is. She's going to read the review for you and then translate it.
Okay, this review is by Vingimo from Brazil, and he says, muito bom, gives 5 stars. He says, mistura simulação de voo com realidade em assuntos muito interessantes. Bom para ficar por dentro desses dois mundos e ainda treinar listening no inglês. So that means it's a mixture of simulation and real flight. With very interesting subjects. It's great to be in these two worlds and still train listening in English.
So great. She sounds great, doesn't she?
Sim, muito bom.
So that's today's review. This review comes from iTunes. This is the primary source where we get reviews and where most people find out about our podcast so that we can continue to share these wonderful interviews and information around the world. And we have an awesome, awesome episode today. This is a very interesting and unique one. I'm not sure if we'll ever have an episode of Aviator Cast like this ever again because we have a world record holder with us today. His name is Matt Guthmiller. He is from South Dakota. However, he has just completed an around-the-world circumnavigation all on his own, so he flew solo around the world, and he was the youngest pilot ever to do so. So I get into an interview with him here, and we talk all about how he did that, some different details about it, and also what the biggest takeaway was, and I think that'll really surprise you. So here is our Hangar Talk interview with Matt Guthmiller.
Now, a special Hangar Talk segment.
All right, everybody. We are honored to have a very special guest with us today, Matt Guthmiller. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing fantastic. You've been a busy guy, a very, very busy guy. So you broke a record recently. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I just became the youngest person to fly solo around the world.
That's pretty impressive. So we want to talk a little bit about that. I know that you've been doing a lot of interviews with other people like CBS. And who else have you done interviews with?
I don't even know. I've kind of lost track.
It's been a blur.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we're going to get into that. But, you know, one unique thing we want about this particular interview with you is most of the listeners here are pilots or aspiring pilots. And so we want some nitty-gritty details on who you are as a pilot, kind of the details of your flight and some other things that you took away from that experience that you could share with the aviation community. So The first thing I ask every guest, no matter who they are, no matter how much experience they are, no matter how many records they've broken, is how did you fall in love with aviation? So tell us about that.
You know, I really don't know. It's just kind of one of those things that I've wanted to do for as long as I can remember. You know, it just always fascinated me, and I always wanted to go eat out at the airport cafe and watch planes take off and land growing up, and played flight simulator games and stuff like that. And then finally got bored one weekend a few summers ago, and I realized I could get my private pilot's license in a few months. So I talked my parents into letting me do a little $20, 20-minute intro flight. And, you know, I think at the time they thought that was just going to kind of be the end of it, you know, get it out of my system. But clearly that didn't happen, and here I am.
Wow. So that was just a few years ago, huh?
Right. That was 2011.
So you've been on a fast pace since then. Tell us about your training schedule from there, you know, after you went on that introductory flight, when you did your first solo, when you actually got your private, how many ratings you have now, how much time you've built, stuff like that.
Sure. Well, so I started, it'd be the end of July of 2011. And just kept with it right away, soloed a couple weeks later at like 10 hours or so, and got my private on my 17th birthday in November 2011. Then got my instrument that following summer, in summer 2012. And then last summer got my commercial and seaplane rating and also a glider rating. And then, of course, this summer I went and flew solo around the world.
Yeah, and that you don't get a rating for that. That's just kind of a rite of passage, something you got to dive into. So what was your favorite rating out of all those? What was the most enjoyable one of those?
I think the just getting my private initially was definitely the most fun. You know, it was just it was so extraordinary going from all of these years of dreaming of flying and playing games and watching planes and stuff like that to actually going out and getting to do it.
Right, exactly. Cool. I always tell everybody that even guys that are older, maybe even retired, that getting a private license is one of the best things you can do. And it's one of those accomplishments that you'll always remember. So it's definitely kind of a poignant time, not only in an aviation career, but in life. It's just one of those moments that's defining.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of pilots out there, a lot of everyday, ordinary pilots, if you will, and not a lot of them get this grand idea that they want to fly around the world. So how did all this come about?
Basically last May in 2013, I read about this guy from California that was going to do it and be the youngest. And he was 20 at the time, ended up being 21 when he set the record. But, you know, I just read about him and thought, gee, I could do that. And so I emailed the article to all of my closest friends and my parents, and of course their initial, and I was like, I'm going to do this next summer. And of course their initial reaction was, sure, good luck with that. Or, I think my dad's response was like, what time are you going to be home tonight? just didn't take it seriously at all, and finally, found a plane to use, put it all together. And then they've been pretty supportive and everything since then. But, for a while, it just felt like a pipe dream that was really never going to happen.
Well, you put it together. It must have taken a lot of research and just getting all of those little steps together, because this isn't the easiest thing. So we're going to get into that a little bit later. First of all, I want to get into kind of I think I understand the purpose of why you did it initially. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that was because you just wanted to do something big, right? You wanted to do it.
Right. I saw that someone else, a few years older than me, was going to do it. And, if he could do it, I could do it. And, and then I decided I wanted to go out and show other people what kinds of things you can do. If you have some big idea, whether it's, going and flying solo around the world or, coming up with some idea and going out and starting a company. I think that if you go out and kind of break it down into all the little pieces and figure out how to put it all together, you can have some big idea and go do it.
Awesome. So yeah, it seems like it bubbled into something bigger, where it was kind of this inspiration that you can actually do big, great, wonderful things, and you do matter, and those sort of things. Did you have any cool interactions while you were out on your flight that people came up to you and were inspired?
Yeah, I mean, you know, all over, it was just amazing to see people's reactions, you know, throughout the entire world. You know, everybody was just so nice and friendly and, you know, thought it was so exciting, wanted to tell everyone about it and stuff like that. You know, there were people that I'd you know, just kind of randomly meet at an airport in, you know, Malaysia or somewhere and you know, tell them what I'm doing. They'd think it was exciting, you know, and take me around town and out for dinner and, you know, go tell all their friends about it and stuff like that. And so it was, it was really nice.
That's neat. I saw some clips of you. You pulled up your bonanza. I don't know what airport it was at, but there were probably 100 people there. And you got out of the airplane. You just kind of, like, you're kind of standing there, like, wow, like, I didn't expect this many people to be here. It's kind of strange, but.
Right. Yeah. I think that was probably Manila. There was, they just had a huge welcome there. I think there were probably more people welcoming me in Manila than when I got back to the U.S.
It really?
Was pretty interesting.
So was Aberdeen your final destination? That's not where you started, was it?
No, it's not where I started, but you know, really, you know, so I started in San Diego at Gillespie Field. So, you know, officially I set the record when I landed back there, but it really wasn't over for me until I got home to Aberdeen, South Dakota.
Awesome. Yep, back home. So was your mom nervous at all? That's kind of a funny question, but did she get nervous or scared or...
You know, I think both my parents were a little nervous, but, you know, they definitely didn't show it too much, and they knew I could do it, so I don't think they were too worried.
Right on. I'm 29 years old, and if I did something like that, my mom would be freaking out the entire time, so it's pretty crazy. Tell us a little bit about the platform that you used to fly around the world. Now, I have time in bonanzas as well. I have, like, 600 hours in bonanzas, so... They're near and dear to my heart, but tell us what kind of equipment you had on board that goes for avionics, any devices you use, like an iPad, iPhone, the apps you used. Tell us all the technical details about how you tracked all this and did all this.
Sure. So, well, it was a 1981 Beechcraft A36 Bonanza. I'm not even sure how many hours are on the airframe, but they just put in a brand new engine, all new avionics, so you know, brand new IO550B, you know, Garmin G500, dual GTN750 touchscreen GPSs, active traffic. I forget exactly which, it's like the GTS 800 or something. You know, so it gives you like clock position call outs, you know, like traffic 2 o'clock high or something, you know, just like air traffic control would. So that was pretty nice in some of these places where they don't have radar and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's that. I think there was, you know, I guess really maybe my favorite part of the whole panel was just that the backup attitude and airspeed and altimeter were also digital. So, you know, just this whole real nice brand new digital panel. I had XM Weather, which only works in the U.S., but then for outside the U.S., I had the Garmin GSR56, which gives you worldwide satellite weather in the form of, like, METARs, TAFs, AirMets, SIGMETs, sort of a crude satellite, infrared satellite depiction, and then also lets you make phone calls and text messages and send text messages all over the world. Then I also had the little DeLorme InReach tracker, which allowed me to, connect to your phone via Bluetooth, and then I could send text messages, unlimited text messages anywhere in the world. So that was really nice for keeping in touch with friends and family and stuff. I had a spot tracker. I had spider tracks. It was kind of all that. And so it was a real nice setup. And then I took out the four seats in the back and added 205-gallon ferry tanks. Wow. And so then I had a couple extra fuel selectors to go with that. You know, the aircraft fuel selector would be off, left, and right, and then right would go to another fuel selector that was either right main, so it just worked like normal, or ferry system. And then if it was on ferry system, that would go to another fuel selector that would be, you know, left or right ferry tank. And
wow. So
there's that to add to it, and, you know, just all of that. And then I guess I also had the digital, I think it's the GPI 930, 830, something like that, digital engine monitoring.
Wow.
So that was very nice to have as well.
It sounds like you had you're never really out of contact, which is comforting. So if you're in the middle of the Pacific, you can basically send your family a text message. Do I understand that right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was actually interesting. There were a few places where I was better connected in the air than on the ground. Sorry about that.
No problem. I can take it out.
Maybe just take a second and I'll figure out if I can mute this.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. I guess I'm not sure how to mute it, but
it's fine.
Hopefully it won't happen again.
Yeah. Is that a landline?
It is.
Funny. Yeah. I didn't know those existed anymore. All right. Okay, here we go again. All right, so now tell us a little bit about, actually, not a little bit. I think this is where the majority of our time is going to be spent. I want to talk about kind of the details of your flight from different perspectives. So we'll talk about, I guess, the planning that you did, fuel problems, or how you dealt with fuel, takeoff performance, weather, customs and immigration, human factors, all that sort of stuff. So we'll kind of dive into each one of those separately. And then if I have any questions, I'll kind of follow up with that. So first off, tell us how this all came together, because you obviously have to break this down into component parts. So from a global scale, looking down on it, how did you start to pick it apart and get all the details figured out?
Well, you know, it was a big, long process. I guess the first thing I did, the biggest problem really, was finding a plane to use, because I didn't own a plane. My parents weren't really sold on buying me a plane. So then I had to find someone to lease me a plane, which, of course, isn't terribly common with small planes. And then someone who would not only lease me a plane, but let me go fly it solo around the world.
Right.
So I spent about 9 months just, going on websites like Controller and just calling everyone that I could find that had, you know, some sort of plane, that they were, selling or maybe even making available for lease that might work for the trip, and calling them, and, the vast majority said, they couldn't help me, or they'd look into it a little bit and get back to me, but, never got back to me. And finally found a guy in San Diego who had a Piper Meridian, and I thought that'd be great because I have a little time in a Meridian, and I figured then I don't have to worry about finding avgas. I got the added reliability of a turbine, stuff mm-hmm. like that. And so I was going to, he was willing to lease me this Piper Meridian and go fly it solo around the world. So I thought, great, and the insurance company thought that was something they could probably work with, and turned out they came back and the insurance to fly a $2 million plane solo around the world for a 19-year-old with 500 hours was a little expensive. And so fortunately, he happened to have a Bonanza instead. And so I went with that, and really it turned out to just be a phenomenal plane for the trip.
Mm-hmm. They're a great platform. I mean, they can carry so much. And you guys actually installed some more fuel system components, let alone the avionics. So tell us about the fuel.
Yeah. So then I guess, the other thing was getting this extra fuel. Fortunately, the guy that was leasing me the Bonanza had done a little work delivering planes, selling and buying planes all over the world. And so he knew a few different ferry pilots, and one of them that does all of his own stuff, puts the ferry tanks in and whatnot. So in May, I flew the plane up to Las Vegas and had him put the tanks in. And, but of course, before he would actually put the tanks in, he made me go fly with him and, do some slow flight stalls, stuff like that, to make sure that I really had a good handle on flying the plane before he'd even put the tanks in. And then it was about a week long process to actually convince the FAA that it was a good idea to sign off on a 19-year-old with 500 hours flying a Bonanza 25% over gross over the Pacific.
Yeah.
But, got that done, got that put together. And then of course there's the issue of just all of the, I guess first of all, just finding airports that had avgas. That's a big one. Once you get past Europe, everybody just has jets, so they only have jet fuel, and so you have to kind of go through it and just find the few places that actually have avgas or that have it in any sort of readily available state, and plan the route around that. And of course, that changes sometimes, and so one person will tell you, yeah, they've got avgas here, and the other one will say, no, they don't have avgas. And
yeah,
I go back and forth, and finally get that all figured out and make a few changes here and there and stuff like that, and then find a couple places to do a little light maintenance and stuff like that. And then, of course, there's permits and things like that to worry about once you get past Europe also. You got to get landing permits for each of the places you're going to land, got to get overflight permits for to fly over different countries. And that turns out to be this big, whole, heavily bureaucratic process. So there's companies that specialize in obtaining those permits, because if you did it yourself, you know, I'd probably still be stuck, you know, in Greece. But so found a couple companies to work with on that. And it was interesting because one of the companies, or like I'd lined up one company to do all the permits, and I thought I was all set there. And then about April or so, right before I was getting ready to leave on the trip, that guy decided he wasn't going to have time for the trip. He had, wasn't going to have time to handle my trip. He just had too many other things going on. So then I had to go find someone else to do the permits, you know, with like a month to go.
Wow.
So that was a little interesting, you know, stuff like that. Of course, little things like vaccines, you know, had to kind of go figure out, you know, what I should worry about, you know, in that respect. And so I got like hepatitis B and typhoid vaccines and stuff like that. And, you know, just all these little things really. And, you know, for the longest time, it just felt like it was never going to happen because I spent so much time just figuring all of these little things out and putting it all together. And, you know, still sitting in my dorm room at MIT, you know, doing finals and planning to go fly around the world in a week. And so, you know, finally though, it, you know, all came together and obviously I made it happen.
That's pretty crazy. I would have never thought about the vaccines thing. Is that something that travel, not a travel agency, but that company that does all the permits suggested, or is that you found out?
Yeah, it was just something I'd come across somewhere, you know, in researching all of this, you know, someone had recommended looking into. And you know, then the CDC actually has a little website that tells you, you know, you just select the country and they'll tell you what vaccine you should get if you're going there, or what vaccine you might consider if you're going there, and interesting, you know, stuff like that.
Wow. So what kind of endurance do you have with all of that fuel on board? How far can you go and how long?
So it varied a bit because I only flew two legs with really sort of full fuel. But those two legs, I had about 19 and a half hours of endurance, and that was running 100 degrees Richter peak. So I knew that, you know, if I really had to, I could go 50 Lena peak and really have quite a bit more endurance even.
Yeah, definitely. So how do you know how far that distance was? Did you figure out like what the distance was? You said endurance is 19 hours, but...
Yeah, well, you know, it was a little hard to figure because, you know, speed varied so much with all that extra weight. You know, I'd start off doing 145 knots or the heaviest leg, I think I probably started off a little closer to 140 knots. You know, and then as I burned off fuel, you know, eventually built that up to about 160 knots. But I figured, you know, at about 150 knots or so, you know, 19 and a half hours is somewhere in the range of like, I don't know, 2,900 miles, 2,900 nautical miles or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I figured I had a solid, 2,900 nautical miles, I guess. And, you know, of course, if I ran Lena Peak, you can probably push that into 3,400 nautical miles.
That's pretty wild. So what was your longest leg?
The longest leg ended up being from Pago Pago, American Samoa to Hilo, Hawaii. That was about 16 and a half hours.
Wow.
I don't remember how many miles it ended up being because I had to go around weather and stuff like that, but that was a long flight.
That's pretty crazy. So you obviously had a little bit of a buffer there too where you could have a bit of, I don't know, contingency plan if you needed to. Obviously, you used some of that going around weather, but... I'm sure that's good to have there. Between American Samoa and Hawaii, is there really anywhere else to land?
There's a couple of small islands that you could land at, you know, if you really had to because of weather, you know, some problem or something. They don't have fuel. There's one that does have avgas. It took me a few days though, just because it varies so much. I had to confirm it, you know, just right when I was getting ready to go from Samoa to Hawaii. So it took a couple of days to actually get a hold of anyone there. But it turned out that Christmas Island, which is about halfway between Samoa and Hawaii, did have avgas.
Oh, okay.
It's about $1,000 a barrel, though.
Oh, my gosh.
And they don't really have like internet or phones there. So it's pretty hard to get a hold of people. And I figured I didn't really want to get stuck there for a couple of days waiting for weather either. Because it was hard enough in Samoa to get on the internet or call people. Mm-hmm. So the idea of just being able to call from the sat phone in the plane didn't seem too appealing. But it was an option. But fortunately, I didn't need it. I was originally planning to go from Samoa to Honolulu. But I ended up going to Hilo instead because I wasn't quite sure, sort of about halfway or so, that I would actually have enough fuel to go to Honolulu. It ended up that I had landed with about 2.5 hours of fuel in Hilo, but yeah.
Right, play it safe.
Right, yeah. So I did 16.5 hours to Hilo, did a couple hours of customs there, and then another hour to Honolulu. So I finally got to Honolulu about 4:30 in the morning.
Wow. And did you have people waiting for you there too, sort of thing? Is that why you wanted to bump over there?
Not really. I the following day I was going to do an oil change in Honolulu, so I had to get there anyway. So I figured I'd just go ahead and get there right then. But it was a little interesting because then I got to the airport in Honolulu and went to the like general aviation parking section, parked the plane, got out, and then there was no one around, and I couldn't figure out how to get out of the airport because I couldn't find a gate. So I finally ended up wandering around and found on Google Maps just a number for the airport, and finally after getting transferred a couple times, got to security and figured out had them send someone to come let me out of the gate because I couldn't figure out how to get to the taxi that was waiting on the other side.
Funny, yeah. I think I know the spot you're talking about. I went flying out there in April, and it's kind of confusing. It's all like locked down and just a little different.
Yeah, well, especially at 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah, well, yeah, everyone's gone. Hardly any traffic that time of night. So,
right.
All right. So, I want to kind of go through an evolution of what it was like on one of those longer legs from a performance perspective. So, you've loaded up the airplane with fuel. You're ready to go in American Samoa. What's your takeoff performance? What are you looking at as far as how you actually go through this procedure, because you don't take this off like a regular Bonanza. This is going to be a completely different flight profile, right? So tell us about that.
Right. And I mean, there's no real published performance data on it. So really, I mean, you're kind of a test pilot just going out and figuring out what it's going to be like. And of course, leading up to that, most of the flights I was about 10% overweight or so. So I did know what it was like to fly heavy, but not anywhere near what it ended up being like, 25 or even a little bit more overweighted. And it did turn out that in Samoa, the fuel, the meter on the fuel pump was off a little bit. So I actually had about an extra 10 or 15 gallons that I didn't even realize I had. So I was even heavier than I was expecting.
Wow.
But, it was definitely a really heavy takeoff. I had to, during fueling, I had to make a sort of a little makeshift tail stand with a little bucket and then a couple bricks that I found laying around to put on the tail tie down ring so that the nose gear would stay on the ground. And then when I hopped in the plane, I had to have someone hold the tail up for me while I got in and got the engine started. And then once the engine was started, I was okay. And it still felt a little bit like I was going to tip over backwards, but just kept the power up and taxied holding the brakes. And then did a little run up and got on the runway. It's a nice long 10,000 foot runway. I still did a little short field takeoff, added full power before releasing the brakes, and probably took about 4,000 or 5,000 feet to get in the air. And then, by the end of the 10,000 foot runway, I'd say I was probably at about 100 or 150 feet. So it was, it was really a slow, climb, and I was climbing out at about 95, 97 knots and getting little chirps at the stall horn. So that was a little nerve-wracking too. Then out over the ocean, you look back and you can see the waves just crashing under the wing. It's interesting view. And then, of course, also because the CG was so far aft, it was very pitchy. So, just every little gust or every little control input, you'd get kind of this big, well, yeah, I don't know. You just get this little pitchy oscillation, and mm-hmm. so it, you know, kind of felt like you were on a boat, you know. And even then, getting up into cruise, you know, which took quite a while to actually climb up. You know, still for the first couple of hours, as the CG was so far aft, you know, just nice little rock, and you know, I could mostly get rid of it hand flying, but it was a little more pronounced with the autopilot. But I did end up using the autopilot, but you know, just because I didn't want to hand fly for 16 and a half hours.
Right, totally.
But, you know, it kind of did feel like I was on a boat for a couple hours there, just this nice little pitch. And, of course, started off at, I guess I climbed up to 7,000 feet initially. I was doing about 145 knots there. And then I got some clouds, so I wanted to stay on top of those so I could kind of keep an eye on the weather. And so then I climbed up through that real slow to 9,000 feet. And there were a couple times there where I just had to – It was like it would do 145 knots, true, in level flight. But as soon as you increase the angle of attack just a tiny bit to start climbing, the airspeed would just bleed off. And so I'd have to – so what I found kind of worked well was to do, you know, build up the airspeed, climb up at, you know, just kind of as much as I could get while the airspeed was bleeding off real fast, you know, get to the stall horn, level off there, and build up some airspeed again, and just keep kind of doing that until I got up to 9,000 feet, because it just wouldn't climb at all otherwise. So that was a little interesting, you know. And got up to 9,000 feet, still did about 145 knots for a few hours, and then that gradually built up to about 160, 165 knots, I suppose, by the time I got to Hawaii. But that was a nice long flight, and of course that was a really tough flight, just in the planning and in the weather. Because, you know, as you cross the intertropical convergence zone along the equator, there's just always thunderstorms. And so the forecast, it really doesn't matter what the forecast says. You know, it'll either say there's thunderstorms and there will be thunderstorms, or there might not be thunderstorms, or it'll say there aren't going to be thunderstorms and there still might be thunderstorms. So you kind of have to just look at the satellite and get the timing right, you know, which, of course, is hard because Samoa is about 7 or 8 hours in a bonanza from the equator, so you have to look at the satellite now, you know, hope that there's a little path there, and then hope that, you know, 8 hours later there's still a little path there. Yeah. So I was kind of stuck there for a couple of days, just waiting for the weather to improve, so I could get that timing just right, and then, you know, finally made it, and you know, just kind of went a little bit by the just real rough infrared satellite image I could get on the data link weather in the plane, and then calling and texting people. To go, you know, look on like weather underground and, you know, get the satellite up and, you know, yeah, tell me where everything was at, and kind of give me a little latitude and longitude of, you know, where it, you know, this hole ended and began and stuff like that. And then I just kind of route like that, and, you know, hopefully by the time I got there, I could find a way around and still have enough fuel to make it all the way to Hawaii.
Right on. That's pretty cool. So we've kind of talked about the performance, and that's all pretty incredible, by the way. It's so different from any other flying that you do, and you're kind of out there on your own, you know, just doing it, just testing these things out and trying to stay safe and thinking on your feet sort of thing.
Right.
What about the human factors part of this? So this is a 16-hour flight. You don't have crew rest or any rules like that. It's all up to you. So what do you do in situations like this? How do you stay awake? How do you stay alert? How do you keep yourself occupied? Because that could get pretty boring. Although, I guess it is pretty exhilarating too, right?
Right. I mean, so that flight in particular, it was pretty easy to stay awake just because, you know, for the first half of it, you know, there's so much going on just to make sure that I was going to be able to get around this weather up ahead, you know, and keeping an eye on exactly where that was at all the time, and, you know, managing the fuel and the pitchiness of the plane and stuff like that. And, you know, and just getting through that. And then once I was actually past that weather and, you know, knew that it was just going to be clear for the rest of the way, you know, then I was just so excited to be finally getting back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, when I land in Hawaii, that, you know, it was just too exciting to fall asleep or something. And I also got a really nice view there, because I got this nice full moon off of one side, the sun just below the horizon on the other side, and then all of these crazy cloud layers, and just, you know, for the kind of hundreds of miles of edge of the this these big storms that I was going around. Really a great view, and you know, and then finally made it to Hawaii. It was a little hard staying awake on the flight from Hilo, Hawaii, over to Honolulu.
Oh yeah,
but you know, the flight actually just getting from Samoa to Hawaii was pretty easy, and of course, really on all of the flights, Coke and Oreos seemed to help.
Yeah, I heard the Oreos thing. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. So those are kind of the two things that I could consistently find all over the world, and so
really?
It worked out pretty well. And, you know, plenty of sugar to keep me awake.
You could be a sponsor for Oreos. I bet they'd love it.
I'll have to look into that.
So so you mentioned the customs and immigration and visa stuff earlier. Did you have any problems with that as you were flying around to these different countries? Did you have any run-ins with the authorities? Did you get intercepted by any jets? Probably not that, but
yeah, nothing too bad. You know, I mean, a lot of these countries, you know, there's a couple hours of paperwork on both ends. You know, you get there, it's a couple hour process to wait for everybody, figure out, you know, all the places that you're gonna have to go, and then, you know, go between all these different, you know, immigration guys, custom guys, you know, whoever else, you know, some quarantine, there's all of these different things to do and stuff like that. So, I mean, it usually took a couple hours on each end, but, you know, on the whole, nothing too bad. In Egypt, at one point, I was with, so one of the groups that I was working with to get all of the permits and everything was called General Aviation Support Egypt. And so they're right in Cairo, and it's kind of run by this one British expat and this Egyptian guy. And so I was with one of them, and we were going around and doing some sightseeing in Cairo, and we went to this little open air market, and it's sort of this Indiana Jones-ish type place. You know, you get to like a little sort of intersection in these like hallways of outdoor marketplace. You know, you look down like all three of them, and, you know, they just look the same, you know, like where the bad guy would slip in to disappear or something.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're going around that and taking pictures of all this stuff, and it's pretty interesting. And apparently someone decided that they didn't like us just walking around taking pictures and not actually buying anything. So we get to the end of it, and a couple of cops come up to us and point to our cameras and tell us that we have to go with him. And so we're kind of freaking out a little bit because we're not sure why we have to follow them. And they don't speak English, so they can't explain. They just kind of point to the cameras, and so we weren't sure if, you know, if it was that someone was just upset we were taking pictures in this market, or if they'd, you know, somehow figured out that we'd been taking pictures of tanks earlier in the day, you know, or something like that. You know, and so we had to follow these cops, and finally, you know, after walking with them down the middle of this busy street for a few blocks, they finally just told us we could go. So it, you know, apparently it was just that, you know, someone was unhappy with us taking pictures, so they wanted to make it look like they were doing something about it. But you know, that was a little interesting. You know, just not something that would happen in the U.S., for example, and, you know, stuff like that. But on the whole, all of that went pretty smoothly.
That's good. And, you know, there's there's the opposite side of that too, right? Where I'm sure one of the things that you felt and learned is that there are wonderful people all over the world. So tell us a little bit about maybe some of those experiences, or that particularly.
Oh, well, I mean, that was great, you know, especially like London and Rome. Well, London, Rome, India, and Malaysia, for example, these General Aviation Support Egypt guys knew different pilots and people in each of those places that they'd worked with in the past. So they'd set me up with them to, you know, go take me around to some sites or out for dinner or something. So in London, I met up with a couple pilots who had flown a Cherokee from London to Australia last fall.
Wow.
And so, you know, went out for dinner with them, had a great time. In Italy, they hooked me up with this pilot they knew there. And so he took a whole day off from work to go take me around to all the sites and, you know, for meals and stuff all day, and that was great. In Greece, the general manager of Starwood Hotels in Greece had found out about my trip on CNN, and so he sent me an email, you know, like, do you have any plans while you're in Athens? And I'm like, no, you know. So he put me up in this, basically it's the nicest hotel in Athens. The president of Azerbaijan was staying there while I was staying there, you know, stuff
that.
You know, hired a little private tour guide to take me around the city, and did my laundry, and gave me a couple bags of snacks to take along on the plane, a big case of bottled water, stuff like that. You know,
wow.
So it was really great. I had lunch with like him and his family, all that kind of stuff. And
Wow.
So just had a great time there. I had a great time in Cairo with these guys from General Aviation Support Egypt I was working with. And then there were other times where I just run into someone at the airport and tell them what I was doing. I think it was pretty interesting and, decided that they were going to drive me around town and take me out for dinner and stuff like that. So it was great. In Hawaii, the taxi driver told the owner of some pub that he went to, about what I was doing. And it turned out that he was a pilot and, thought it was really interesting. So he gave the taxi driver, some free, really good fish and chips to bring me when he picked me up at the hotel to go back to the airport to fly to California and stuff like that. So there's just all these little things everywhere, where people were just really nice and friendly, and it was really great.
That's great. Probably one of the best parts of the trip.
Yeah, it really was. It's especially really nice when you're flying around the world by yourself to just have all of these people everywhere that are just so nice to you.
Yeah, totally. So I want to talk a little bit about some experiences that taught you about flight safety. So some things you learned on this flight it's hard to just call this a flight, but this journey, this excursion, this adventure that you've been on, things that specifically taught you something new about flight safety. Does anything stand out as far as that's concerned?
I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. There were definitely a lot of things that I kind of learned, and a few things where I thought, how did I get myself into this position? But there are little things like just like those heavy takeoffs, and just being real careful about airspeed and really kind of understanding, that you fly the plane, you don't pay attention necessarily to exactly what your airspeed is because you don't know what it's supposed to be and stuff like that, and just keeping the plane in the air and, sticking with basics. Like, if you get a little gust and all of a sudden you're sinking at 200 feet a minute and you're only 200 feet above the ocean, you just got to put the nose down and go with it and get some airspeed and not, pull back and stall and end up in the water or something like that. And, with weather, just, sitting on the ground, in the middle of nowhere for a couple of days if you have to, and then going and being prepared to go around some weather or come back or go somewhere else or something like that. And it was so different dealing with thunderstorms there because, I'm so used to here. Most of the time if there's some thunderstorms, a lot of times I don't even give a second thought to it. I just go hop up in the air and air traffic control has weather radar. They give you vectors around it and you're all set. And of course, most of the rest of the world, especially out of the ocean, they don't have weather radar. So, it's fine because most of the traffic there is just airliners. So they all have their own weather radar. But for me, I just had to stay out of the clouds and, make sure I could see, where the really tall ones were and avoid those. And, sometimes that meant, finding, you'd see a couple holes and I'd usually try to pick the brighter one and, hope that on the other side it was clear. And sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. I had to turn around and come back and either try the other hole or just go, 100 miles, left or right of course and go around the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And, and then of course, the whole time you're doing that, keeping track of how much fuel you've got and how long it's going to, how much time that's going to add to the flight and make sure you can still make it or, have some alternate or something and stuff like that. And so it was really, a lot of decision making, a lot of, sticking to the basics and making sure that everything was as safe as it could possibly be while also, being out there and doing these really long flights and, in crazy exotic places all by myself.
Right. I think that's one of the things I've noticed throughout our conversation is that there wasn't necessarily anything scary or unforeseen, but that's largely because of the planning you had ahead of time and the decisions you made while you were on the trip, whether those be decisions you made on the ground or decisions that you made on the fly while you were in the air, really just, breaking that chain that leads to accidents and making sure that you're doing everything correctly. So it sounds like, particular speaking about your, the one we got into detail with between American Samoa and Hawaii that, every step of the way, you're just thinking about what you needed to do for that flight moment and what that flight moment meant for the future of the flight, and, you know, things like stopping in Hilo instead of going to Honolulu, little decisions like that that could end up being a potential problem down the road that, you know, you made, and it turned out great. And so it was uneventful, and that's kind of what you want from a flight safety perspective, but it was very eventful from the perspective of this being such an amazing journey.
Sure.
So what advice do you have for upcoming pilots, for people that are wanting to get their license? Let's say that they're not necessarily even young guys. What advice would you give them?
You know, I guess really the biggest sort of takeaway that I've had from this whole thing, and that I hope everybody else has, is just that, you know, I think I've probably mentioned this before, but, you know, just that you can have some idea, go out and break it down, figure out how to go do it. You know, whether that's flying around the world or having an idea and going starting a company, or just getting your private, you know, there's all kinds of little issues you might have, you know, figuring out how to pay for it, figuring out how to, you know, fit it into your schedule, things like that, you know, or just, you know, getting over some little hump in, you know, some little issue that you encounter while training, you know, something you just can't quite get down. You know, you just got to go out and break it down and analyze it. And you can, you know, there's always a way to make something happen. And, you know, just go do it. And, you know, of course, flying is a lot of fun. You know, I'd recommend it to anyone. And, you know, it was a lot of fun just, you know, growing up and going out and eating at the airport cafe and playing flight simulator games and stuff. But, you know, actually doing it for real is just so much better, and such an incredible experience. And, you know, it just gives you so much freedom, you know, whether it's, you know, you can go do something like this and go fly around the world, or just go fly 10 minutes with a couple friends to go find some interesting new restaurant in a little town nearby or something. You know, mm-hmm. There's just so much you can do with it.
Right, definitely. So when you first started out, you mentioned that you used flight simulators back in the day. Do you feel like that helped you eventually get into flying?
I think so. You know, there were just so many things that I knew going in because of that it, you know, definitely probably made things easier. And, you know, I think instrument flying especially, because I, you know, it's one kind of one thing I found, especially with like computer flight simulator games, is, you know, the panel takes up the whole screen. So you end up, you know, at least, you know, I'd always go fly the big jets, you know, and try to, you know, fly some ILS in just horrible, awful weather conditions and stuff like that. You know, it's when I got into a real plane, you know, flying ILS, you know, perfect weather under the hood for the first time, you know, it's just a piece of cake. But, you know, so I think that definitely helps, you know, and you just learn so many little things, you know, about, even I guess like I always played Microsoft Flight Simulator, and so they have, you know, like a little simulated air traffic control. So I even knew, you know, a lot about sort of how that worked and that phraseology and stuff like that. And, you know, so it's just, I'd say it definitely helps. And, you know, had a lot of fun before I could start flying.
Yeah.
Because of it.
I think my experience was a lot the same as yours, because I went through my youth not necessarily wanting to be a pilot the whole time, but it was always just kind of around. You know, I did model airplanes, I did the flight simulator thing, and then one day I'm like, I can actually become a pilot and get a license, so why don't I just do it, you know?
So, right, exactly.
It's just one of those things. And one thing I like about your advice was that you said to find ways to do it. And I think that's what a lot of people need to do, is they need to get creative about how they actually pursue these things, whether that be, like you said, getting a pilot license or starting a company or whatever. But specifically to a pilot license, you got to be creative about how you get there, because I think we all think about it, or most people think about it, in the sense of doing it dollar for dollar, you know, just straight out paying for it. But what I see in your experience is that you didn't just go out and buy an airplane. You know, you found partners along the way, if you will, people on your team, if you will, that helped you along the way, like this guy that leased the airplane. It all kind of worked out. It wasn't the exact path you thought it was going to be, but it all worked out in the end, because you kind of had that intention that it was going to happen. So I think that's definitely a good lesson.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting, because a couple months before I'd even gotten this whole idea to go fly around the world, I'd looked into just a little bit, you know, what it would be like, you know, if it would be possible to go fly a small plane like over to Europe or something. And I thought it'd be a cool way to, you know, take a few friends and go explore Europe or something. And, you know, found out that people do it. And there's even little companies that'll organize, you know, sort of a, you know, plan it all out for you and you know, make it into a little vacation with like a group of planes and stuff like that. And, but, you know, is it just really expensive? And so I thought, you know, well, I guess it's possible, but that, you know, that's something I'll do 30 years from now when I retire from whatever I end up doing.
Right.
But, you know, then I read about this other kid and realized, you know, gee, I could go do that too, you know, and find ways to make it work, you know, and raise money and, you know, and support a really cool charity along the way and stuff like that. And figured it all out and actually made it happen. You know, and I never would have dreamed that it would have, you know, before that, but, and even, you know, like I said, for the longest time, it still felt like it wasn't going to happen. But I finally just figured out a way to make it happen, and you can do that with anything.
And now you've done it. Has it settled in yet at all? Have you kind of come to grips with all of this?
You know, it's still just a really weird feeling. You know, it was a really weird feeling when I got back to California and, you know, just went from these, you know, this month and a half of flying for 12 hours, spending a few days in an exotic new location, flying for another 12 hours and just repeating that, and then finally just being done. You know, that was just a really weird feeling. But now to think back and realize that, you know, I was flying by myself in this little bonanza over the pyramids a month ago.
Yeah.
Or you know, a month and a half ago. It's just crazy. You know, it's really, I mean, it was a wonderful experience. It was a lot of work, but it's just so surreal.
So out of everything that we've talked about so far about this journey that you've taken, what's the biggest takeaway that you have from your experience?
You know, I think the biggest thing, you know, like I said, you know, there's the aviation safety aspect of it. You know, we're just, you know, sticking to all these basics that you learn as you're getting your private license. You know, you make that work, you know, on a huge scale like this to make something, you know, just really safe, but also just, you know, I was really impressed by all of these just incredibly friendly, kind people that I met all over the world. And just to see that that's sort of the, you know, the landscapes, the cultures would change, but the one constant was just, you know, finding these incredible people everywhere. That was really interesting to kind of experience.
That's cool. I really like that. It's not aviation, but then again it is, because that's how you got there, and it's pretty incredible. And, you know, along with that, I find that there are people all over the world that are not only great and wonderful people, I definitely believe that, but there are people that love aviation. It's like this universal language and this universal desire to want to be in the air, and I think that's quite incredible.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, so any last words before we sign off here?
You know, I think we've covered everything, yeah. But like I said, again, you know, just you have some idea, go out, figure out how to do it, and get it done.
All right. Will do. I'm going to take your advice as well. So really appreciate you being on the show, and we hope to hear more from you. I hope you go for another record of some kind. That'd be cool.
Yeah, we'll see. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Appreciate it, Matt. Thanks.
Bye.
All right, so how incredible was that? It's quite amazing what Matt has done flying around the world, but what's even more amazing is how it was all put together, and actually the biggest takeaway he has is all the wonderful people that helped him out along the way on his journey. And one thing that I mentioned in our interview with him is that I found that there are just so many people around the world that love aviation, and it's this universal language that we all understand. We just want to fly. We have this desire to fly, and it's so great that so many people took care of him along the way. Congratulations, Matt. It took a lot of hard work. I'm sure it won't settle in for a while as far as how big this actually was, but you did a fantastic job, and I really thank you for joining us on this episode of AviatorCast. I'm sure that you will have inspired many of our listeners here, and so it is much appreciated. Keep up the awesome work. We hope to hear more from you, and keep at it. Throttle on, as we say. We'd love to hear your thoughts, you listeners out there. You can truly shape this show and the topics we provide. Take a quick 2-minute survey at survey.aviatorcast.com. Do you want to be part of the AviatorCast community or leave a comment? Go to aviatorcast.com to join in or write me directly at me@aviatorcast.com. Say you don't want to miss an episode of AviatorCast? No worries. You can subscribe through email at aviatorcast.com on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or SoundCloud. iTunes is one of the best sources to do that, to subscribe, but it really depends on the other services that you use and what you like to use most for your podcasts. We'd also love to get an honest review from you on iTunes. This helps others learn about AviatorCast so they can join in and enjoy it as well. That is one of the best ways to let people know. And you saw that in action today, my wife reading that review from Brazil. Pretty neat that all over the world people are listening to AviatorCast, and that's how they find out about it, is generally through reviews on iTunes and if you share it on social networks, things like that. If you'd like to check out any of our training products here at Angle of Attack, head to flyaoamedia.com. Start with the basics for free with Aviator 90. Learn instrument flying and more with Aviator Pro, or even fly many of the world's most popular jets virtually with our training products for the 737, 747, 777, and MD-11. Again, at flyaoamedia.com. Angle of Attack also offers professional video services at angleofattackpro.com, so you can check us out there. Many thanks also go out to the Angle of Attack crew for all of their work to make this episode possible, and all they do outside AviatorCast. These guys are absolutely awesome. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of AviatorCast. I hope you felt inspired to go out and do something big. We are truly grateful to have you here, part of our community, and so engaged in this wonderful passion for flying things. Until next time, throttle on.
10-5-8 is ready. 10-5-8 is the shoreline. Turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000. Runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff. 25 right. United 580.